Welcome. This is an audio recording of the World Affairs Council of Dallas-Fort Worth. I'm Jim Falk, President of the Council. The Council is a nonprofit membership organization dedicated to engaging the public in an exploration of global issues and foreign affairs, and we produce over 80 public events each year. To learn more about us or to become a member, visit dfwworld.org. This podcast is made possible through the generous support of Haynes & Boone, LLP. We hope you enjoy it.
Thank you for being with us this morning. We are quite honored to have Dr. Richard Haass with us, who has an impeccable reputation. And his bio and his accomplishments are so immense that I do not dare even go through it because I know it's going to be more interesting for you to hear what Dr. Haass has to say to us today. But it is a privilege. We are honored to have you, Richard. And I believe Randall and I have agreed to set up the exploratory committee for you as President of the United States.
Well, actually, I'm already President, just as something else. And there are days I prefer my job. It's great to be here. It's one of my favorite cities, and thank you all for doing this. If timing is a lot in life, we've had pretty good timing this morning. There's one or two things to think about. But before I get into the details of Crimea, let me just take a step back. And we can delve into that as much as anybody here would like. But let me just sort of set it up, because I do think it's important to see this in context. If I were going to focus on what it is we need to worry about in the world, I actually, up to 2 weeks ago, would not have focused on Europe. And Europe is, as Ronald Reagan used to say, largely whole and free. It was the principal theater of 20th century geopolitical competition. You had two world wars and a Cold War. And as here we are in the second decade of the 21st century, and Europe is not at the center of international relations. That's a good thing. I used to, when I had the Middle East account when I worked for 41 at the White House, I used to say my goal was to make the Middle East as boring as Europe. I clearly failed. But Europe, has been boring. That's good. When Europe was interesting, it was all too interesting. And it's actually a relief to have it, and that we've had a little bit of an anomaly here. But I do think the basic outlines of this new century are pretty clear. And despite what Mr. Putin's done, I actually see that more as an exception rather than as the introduction of a new fault line, if you will, to international relations. The three things that worry me most in this era, one is the greater Middle East. The part of the world that's absorbed U.S. attention for the last decade plus. And I simply see no evidence that the Middle East is on the threshold of sorting itself out. I know Americans are optimistic, Texans are particularly optimistic, and you all think that things, when they get bad, they have to get worse before they get better. Well, let me just suggest in the Middle East, things have to get worse before they get even worse. And this is still the early days of bad things. And if there's a historical reference to what is going on in the Middle East, you may want to go directly from here to Bloody Mary's after you hear me talk. It is early 17th century Europe. And for those of you who don't remember your European history 101, early 17th century Europe was dominated by three decades of political religious wars into what is basically today Germany. And it became known as the 30 Years' War for the obvious example that it lasted that long. And it was civil wars, there was regional wars, and the rest. And there's a lot about the Middle East that reminds me of that, where I could imagine this going on for decades, like we're seeing in places like Syria, civil wars, you have regional countries coming in, it's spreading across borders, so things like the Syria-Iraqi border doesn't count for much anymore. the problem is a couple of strong local states, but even more, it's weak states. That are weak states that can't control what goes on inside of their borders. And what's so dangerous then is that can become breeding grounds, as we've seen, for terrorists, pirates, what have you. But I think that is the future of the Middle East. And it will continue for some time to come with obvious repercussions for the potential for global terrorism. Humanitarian tragedies are enormous. Just from Syria alone, you've probably got already 150,000, 200,000 people dead, something like 5 or 6 million people either internally displaced or who have been turned into refugees. It's got questions for the stability of the region with proliferation, the questions of Israel, and obviously energy. So that will continue to bubble, and I see nothing that will change that for an awfully long time. The ability of outsiders, including ourselves, to make a meaningful difference in the trajectory of the Middle East is extraordinarily modest. Second part of the world that worries me couldn't be more different. It's much more classic, and that's Asia. Because there you do have great powers that are pretty stable. India, China, Japan, Korea, Vietnam, what have you. And there what we're seeing is after decades and decades of economic growth that was really off the charts, double digits in the case of China, quite robust in many other countries, the growth has slowed down. And what we're beginning to see is as the economic flow, the politics are picking up. And what we're beginning to see in Asia, if you will, pardon the phrase, is the return of history. Because history is never just economic. Chris, history is also politics and economics and friction between states, and that's exactly what we're seeing. And what's worrisome about Asia is that what is missing from Asia are any sort of shock absorbers. There's virtually nothing in the way of local arrangements or institutions to dampen down the friction or to manage it if it happens all the same. For example, there's nothing in place like the United States and the Soviet Union had to keep our forces from operating, to keep forces from operating close to each other, naval and air forces. So if Japan and China tomorrow, it's quite possible the Japanese air forces or naval forces and Chinese air forces and naval forces will come into some sort of a conflict. If it happens, they don't have the dedicated hotlines to manage it. So you don't even have the rudimentary political, military, or diplomatic arrangements. So I'll take another comparison with Europe. The great advantage of Europe after World War II is not simply the growth of institutions, the European Community, Union, and all that. The other is the countries that were at the core of so much European history, France, Germany, and the rest, have reconciled. Well, guess what? No one in Asia has reconciled. Not Japan with Russia, not Japan with Korea, not Japan with China, not China with anybody else. You have territorial issues, galore at sea, and so forth. So Asia is essentially a place where a lot of countries have been growing economically, have been building up their militaries, nationalism is getting stronger, and there's very few mechanisms for controlling it. And this is the part of the world that has the lion's share of the world's people and increasingly has the lion's share of the world's wealth. So it's a totally different set of challenges than the Middle East, but just as significant, if not more significant in its own way, because whereas the Middle East is under 400 million people and no great powers, Asia has billions and billions of people and has the major powers of the era. So those are two things that I keep my eye on. The third is not a geographic challenge so much as a functional challenge. And there I'd say, one of the great phenomena of the age is what? It's globalization. It's all the stuff that moves in tremendous scale. It's vast and fast, tremendous velocity across borders. It could be good stuff or bad stuff. It could be emails. It could be greenhouse gases. It could be terrorists. It could be tourists. It's a range of stuff. And the mechanisms for the global arrangements or mechanisms for dealing with this are lacking. There's a tremendous gap between these global challenges and the arrangements in place to keep them. And it means potentially getting overwhelmed by parts of them, whether it's climate change, if nothing is done, proliferation, you got breakdowns in the operation of the world trading or monetary system, you could have a disease, or take something that's very benign, the internet. This year, you have two major international conferences, one in Brazil next month, one in Korea in October. What are their purposes? Their purposes are to, quote-unquote, regulate the Internet. Well, look out. Last I checked, the Internet was working pretty well. And it was working in part pretty well because it wasn't being regulated by government so much as it had grown up around the technology and what are called stakeholders around the world to make it operate. Well, now governments decided they don't like the Internet so much because it carries ideas that could threaten the monopoly of information that authoritarian regimes want to maintain. They're worried about the fact that many of the companies benefiting are American. Yeah, the NSA surveillance problems, and lots of countries erroneously think if only they could somehow break up the Internet, they would make themselves safer from surveillance. It's not true, but that idea has gained some currency. So the real question is, will this phenomena that has done so much to fuel what makes modern life so successful, will it be able to continue to function the way it has? Possibly not. So there's a real threat. And it's this question of how does one deal with these global challenges and how does one regulate them in a constructive way and not either let them run wild or regulate them in a unconstructive way. So those to me are the three things that worry me most. We now have to add Europe to it. That said, I don't think this is structural, what's going on in Crimea. I think what happened was you had the dysfunctional politics of Ukraine. And essentially, there was a battle over the future of Ukraine. This is a country of roughly 45 million people, borders on Russia and several other countries. It was one of the constituent parts of the Soviet Union. And essentially, you had a struggle for the orientation of Ukraine. Was it going to be in the orbit of Europe, or was it going to be in the orbit of Russia? So you had this is a country that was politically dysfunctional and economically bankrupt. So it had competing proposals, if you will, one coming out of Europe, one coming out of Moscow. And the president of Ukraine, who was tilting towards Moscow, needless to say, a lot of the people in Kiev and western Ukraine wanted him to tilt towards Europe, and that's why you had the violence that you had, the protests you had, and Mr. Yanukovych was essentially chased out of Dodge. For those of you who, again, like European history, it was very reminiscent of what was happening in Paris, of all places, in the mid-19th century. So he left Dodge, and you've had this kind of stand-up. But when the pro-Russian leader left power, Mr. Putin, I believe, got very nervous because this would have been a major diplomatic and strategic loss for him, a real loss of face. But also even more, it wasn't just strategy, it wasn't just face. He was worried that if Ukraine went European, so to speak, it would then become more liberal, more European. Bad enough that 45 million people on your border were going that way. What would people at home think? Mr. Putin is about one thing, which is Mr. Putin staying in power. The idea that the virus of liberalism and Europeanism could take root in Ukraine, that virus could spread to Russia, that was a threat that Mr. Putin, I believe, decided he couldn't countenance. Hence his move into Crimea. If you've been to Crimea, this is, by the way, it's in the south, it's on the sea, it's where the Russians have their historic port. But also, if you go to Crimea, you feel, quite honestly, like you're in Russia. Everybody speaks Russian. It's the region of Ukraine that is the most Russian ethnically and linguistically. And until 60 years ago, not only was all of Ukraine in the Soviet Union, but the Crimea wasn't even in Ukraine. In that state within the Khrushchev made a transfer 60 years ago in 1954, if my math is correct. So that is backdrop. So Mr. Putin moved against Crimea. And he did it ostensibly to protect his kith and kin, the ethnic Russians, the Russian-speaking people there. I don't know. It wasn't that they were under tremendous threat, so I find that a little bit hard to believe. My hunch is he did it as a face-saving move, that he was worried he had lost most of Ukraine as Yanukovych was chased from power. This was his way for compensating, and this is a way to save face at home and limit, if you will, the spread of the virus. Having done that, we all assume that people in political life who run countries have plans. Let me just throw the wild idea out to you that Mr. Putin is improvising and that he did this as a reaction to events. And now we could go one of three ways. And I don't know which one he goes. One is he could use this to trade. He could basically say, if you want me out of Crimea, especially as a bargaining chip, you have got to reopen the negotiations about Ukraine's economic future and come up with something that's joint between Europe and Russia. And you've got to establish special protections or autonomy for the people, for the Russian ethnics in Crimea. And if that's the case, the crisis will go away. We won't much like what he did, and it will make people a lot more sober about Mr. Putin, but the crisis will fade. And that's essentially, he trades in his physical occupation for economic and political outcome that he wants. That's one possibility, and that is the least malign of the opportunities. Second is he decides to sit in Ukraine, and I'm just to sit in Crimea. He basically says, I don't have confidence about the future orientation of Western or European Ukraine. I assume it's going to go that way. This is going to be the way. I'm permanently going to save face, kind of have a buffer so the virus can't spread, and it gives me a little bit of leverage over what happens. They'll never quite know what I might do next. And that's a kind of occupation of this chunk of the country. And the third option is he not only sits in Crimea, but he decides that's not enough, and he wants to expand his foothold to much larger chunks of Ukraine, including conceivably Western Ukraine. I don't know what he decided. I don't know that he's decided. I don't know what he might decide. So the purpose of our foreign policy at this point in here has to be to shape his decision-making. So I would say we work on all three fronts. We would have talks. If you'll see what we're doing with Ukraine is quite right. We're giving them an immediate injection of emergency money. We're going to have a much larger negotiation with them about a much larger sum of money under what conditions they would accept it. I would actually say bring the Russians to the table if they want. Give them at least a chair at the table, see if they're willing to use it constructively. Part of the conditions for this large chunk of money, whether it's $12 billion or $15 billion, ought to be special protections for the people of Crimea and eastern Ukraine. So we'll see. We'll see if we can't take Putin at face value, see if we can't take away his concerns. That's one. Second of all, if it turns out we can't, then we ought to start ratcheting up significantly the sanctions, not just not going to the G8 or suspending Russia from the G8, but economic sanctions. It turns out that Russia is much more integrated in the global economy than many people realize, and any time you're integrated, you're vulnerable. And, you know, Russia's a cash crop economy. It's largely a one-dimension economy. But it is still very vulnerable. You saw what happened to the markets there. You saw what happened to the currency. So that gives us extraordinary leverage, and we could really tighten the screws. And the kind of sanctions, for example, financially, that were put into place against Iran, just a sniff of that, I think, would send Russian markets down another 10, 20, 30%. And I'm not sure Mr. Putin wants to experience that kind of pain. So we have those kinds of options if he decides to sit there. We could also begin to strengthen some of Ukraine's neighbors, send ballistic missile defense to Poland, do some things like that. We could change our energy policy. Why wouldn't we announce today? If I were at the White House, I would be pushing as hard as I could for an announcement the United States is going to start exporting LNG, liquefied natural gas, and crude oil. We're going to start using all the energy we've been producing as a strategic asset. And let's do that. And one of the purposes would be to wean countries that were dependent on Russia for their energy away. It takes time. The oil could get there right away. The gas would take longer. But why don't we start doing that, which sends a real strategic message to Russia that your one principal piece of leverage is a diminishing asset. Why wouldn't we do that? And then lastly, if things were to escalate, we could do even more things militarily in terms of strengthening Ukraine or even directly coming to its help. I'd rather not go down those directions because the more it gets militarized, everyone's going to lose. So my goal at the moment would be to get Mr. Putin to recalculate. I think he's also got to be a little bit worried. I mean, Russians are famous for playing chess. I'm not sure Mr. Putin's playing chess. Every once in a while, leaders get in trouble when they play checkers and not chess. And I'm not sure he's three or four moves ahead. And he's got to play this out because depending upon how he is perceived at home. If he is perceived as having lost or gambled and not come out well, then obviously he makes himself vulnerable. So we can use, I think, his desire to maintain power at all costs at home, potentially to our advantage. And that's where, again, the economy could be something of his Achilles heel. This all said, I don't think Europe is about to once again become a principal theater of international relations and competition and conflict. I could be wrong. I'm wrong all the time, but I don't. I still think that the principal areas are going to be, for the reasons I described, the Middle East, Asia, and, if you will, the global terrain, but Latin America, Africa. There's many good stories, and there's not systemic problems there, and I don't think Europe is a systemic problem. What should we do about all this, then? Ukraine I've just talked about in detail. Let me very quickly talk about the others. The Middle East, I think we have to stop trying to do what we've done for the last decade, which is stop trying to remake it in our image. Ain't going to happen. The idea the United States is going to bring about societies there that accept our values, accept our politics, and the rest, it's just not on. They're just not at that stage in history. If I'm right, again, the Middle East is going to be, the gentle word would be turbulent, for decades to come. But this idea, this American project of trying to make the Middle East tolerant, democratic, and the rest, is misguided. I get in a lot of trouble for saying this, but there you have it. And we have overreached. And we've sent, you know, we sent 2 million Americans to either altogether to Afghanistan or Iraq. We put in, you know, more than $1 trillion, put in more than a decade, and I simply don't believe we have results that are commensurate with that. The process of, there's no more difficult undertaking in this business than to try to influence the trajectory of other societies. You come up against history, culture, traditions, identities, extraordinarily difficult, and it ought to be humbling. And I simply don't think that effort can succeed regardless of what it is we try to do. So we ought to go back to a much more, I believe, traditional notion of American foreign policy, where the principal thrust of what it is we do abroad is to influence the foreign policies of others rather than their domestic natures. I'm not saying we turn our backs on those things, but the principal purpose of foreign policy, the areas for which our tools are most relevant, is actually to affect foreign behavior rather than in internal nation. That actually works to our advantage in Asia, because the kinds of things we can do, trade, diplomacy, air and naval forces, that's exactly what Asia needs to keep stability and to keep it from going off the rails. So we not only have greater interest in Asia, we're better positioned to affect those interests than we are in the Middle East. So one of the things I would say we've got to stop doing is trying to overreach to remake the Middle East and the world in our image. The second thing, though, we've got to do is avoid just the opposite. And I am concerned in this country that the combination of disappointment and disillusionment with intervention, the kind of fatigue from it, the persistent problems at home have led people to the other extreme, which is, if you will, okay, we're tired of overreaching. Let's come home, America. We're beginning to see isolationism grow in this country significantly. Just this week, a CBS News poll showed that by more than 2-1, 65-31%, Americans said the United States should not be taking the lead in the world in solving international conflicts. Another Gallup poll about 2 weeks ago asked Americans, what's your biggest concern? And then they clustered the responses. Nowhere in the top 10 responses was anything to do with the world. So this growth in it's an opposite and equal reaction to overreach that you have underreach, but it's dangerous. It also, I think, comes from the fact our schools don't. I know we have some students here, but by and large, most schools don't teach this well. Our media doesn't, for the most part, cover the world well, and people don't see the fundamental linkage between what goes on out there and what happens here. And so we can't thrive in a world that's chaotic. And the world will be chaotic unless we're taking the lead. There's no one else who has the capacities or inclinations to play the sort of role we have. Not China, not anybody else. So I think there's a powerful argument against isolationism, but we are beginning to see it again. And by the way, this is not confined to either party. I see it in the Republican Party. I see it in the Democratic Party. And lastly, I would say that in order to deal with these international challenges in the Middle East, particularly in Asia, the global ones and the rest, we've got to put our house in order. We've got to have the resources. We've got to have the personnel and so forth. And that means dealing with our economy. We're still growing at a much slower rate than we should. It means dealing with entitlements. Yes, the budget's going down. The budget deficit's going down. But let's not kid ourselves. In about 6 to 8 years, sure as shooting, the budget deficit is going up significantly. It's going to go up because of the obligations tied to entitlements, Social Security, and above all, Medicare, as the baby boomers get older. The only other thing I know that's going up are interest rates. Mr. Fisher's right. They will go up, maybe not as soon as he wants, but they will go up. And what they do, the combination of entitlements going up and interest rates going up means the service on the American debt is also going to skyrocket, and it's going to crowd out other forms of spending, which works against our competitiveness. We need to have immigration reform. It is truly nutty to educate the best and brightest around the world and then not let them stay here and start up businesses and work here. Joe Biden the other day got into trouble for describing the airport where I live, LaGuardia, as a third world airport. So I went on Twitter and I said, you know, yet again the vice president's wrong describing LaGuardia as a third world airport. I spent a lot of my life in third world airports. They're a lot better than LaGuardia. Our infrastructure is an embarrassment, and there are things that can and should be done about it. Schools. People line up all over the world at consulates and embassies to come to America's elite universities. How many people line up around the world to come to America's public high schools and its inner cities? Answer, not a hell of a lot. And by and large, we're not competitive. You know, we're 20, 25, 30 on various lists in skill sets with high school kids. So we're not going to be able to have the physical resources, the economic resources, the human resources to lead in the world. We're not going to be competitive. We're not going to be resilient. We're not going to be able to set an example unless we turn things around here at home. So that is essentially, you know, my own thinking now is we've got to slightly dial it down in the Middle East. We've got to dial it up in Asia. We've got to try to get it right between too little and too much international involvement. And we've got to understand that national security depends on, think of it as a coin. I'll leave you with this thought, then I'll stop. National security is a coin with two sides. One side is foreign policy. We've got to get the mix of foreign policy right. But the other side of national security is domestic. It's the economic, it's the society, and we've got to get that right. And unless we get both sides of the national security coin right, we will leave ourselves less secure. So again, the answer is to avoid trying to remake the world, it's to avoid withdrawing from the world, but also we've got to get the home front right, because this is the foundation of all that we are and all that we do. So why don't I stop at that, and anything is fair game. Thanks very much. Here, you bump it to this.
Richard, I think I gave you a fair warning that the students' questions were often zingers. We have one of those for you today. Here's the question from a high school student here in Dallas. Does the president still have credibility with world leaders when he continues to set red lines, like in Syria, and is feckless in doing anything when countries step over them? Would you say that this is a show of strength or weakness?
Well, let me answer it this way. The president still has credibility because he's still the president of the United States of America. And when it comes to foreign policy, under our political system, under our Constitution, the president has tremendous discretion. Indeed, my prediction is, you know, over the next, almost 3 years, what's left of his presidency, he will become more of a foreign policy president, not because he loves foreign policy, but it's harder to get stuff done domestically. And again, he has more latitude overseas. But he's hurt himself. And when you say things are red lines, and then when people cross the red lines and then you don't act, you raise questions, not just locally, but throughout the world. I've had a lot of Asian leaders speak to me about the what they should make of what the president did in Syria. Not because they're directly affected by Syria, but because they basically said, gee, if he can't be counted on there, how do we know he can be counted on here? So I think we paid a large price, he paid a large price, for the irresoluteness, I guess I'd say, about Syria. I also got upset at the beginning of the Ukraine crisis when a lot of American officials were running around the world saying, this is unacceptable. Well, when I worked in government, that was a word I really reserved for very few situations, because the last I checked, when you go to the dictionary, unacceptable means you won't accept it. That means you will do whatever it takes to reverse something. But we're not saying that. We're not going to send in the 82nd Airborne into Crimea. So we should not use words like unacceptable. We should say this is destabilizing, this is uncalled for. I can think of 87 other adjectives I'd use. And then I would gear all sorts of responses that I believe would get the job done and would commensurate with the mistakes. But I'd be very careful about the use of language, because when you are president, you're never narrow casting. Everything you do sends precedents. Everything you think you're doing on one square of the chessboard has consequences or implications for every other square of the chessboard. So I think we've simply hurt ourselves. I'd also say what's hurt ourselves tremendously is not just the president, but it's the Congress. Equal opportunity here. Things like debt, threatening to default on the debt, shutdowns of government, sequesters. This has raised tremendous questions about American seriousness, its reliability, its predictability. Countries around the world say to themselves, my God, do I want my security to be dependent on a country that shuts down its government? Are you crazy? So the president hurt us by what he did at Syria, but trust me, the Congress has hurt us significantly by its behavior over the last few years.
One more student question, then we'll open it up.
Then we'll get to the easy ones.
Yeah. They're zingers. I'm going to modify this a little bit because you've already addressed to some degree and in some detail the Ukrainian situation. But the end of this question is, what precedent will be set in Ukraine for the nation's foreign policy generally? And the kind of question that occurs to me is, will our response to the situation in Ukraine influence perhaps the Chinese evaluation of how they handle things in the South China Sea?
It's a good question. It's a little bit unknowable. It comes back to what I was just talking about, that what you do anywhere affects perceptions everywhere. That said, Ukraine is where it is. By that I mean, it's like real estate. The old saw is three rules of real estate: location, location, location. Same thing is true of geopolitics. Ukraine is on the border of Russia. Russia does have a set of stakes that's different than ours. So it would be a mistake to say what the United States does and doesn't do, how the United States acts in a place like Ukraine is a template for what might be done in the South China Sea or anywhere else. We don't have alliance relations with Ukraine. We do have alliance relations with Japan. So I think there's a danger in overreading. And what I would, if I were at State or the White House, I would be making sure that people understood that they would understand how serious we took it, all the things, and so forth. And even, just as an aside, countries like China shouldn't much like the idea of somebody intervening to break away parts of countries. That ought to be something that would give them pause, so that they should not necessarily reflexively come to Russia's. I hate it. But I would also be doing things to send signals that even if there were certain limits militarily to what we were prepared to do in Ukraine, one shouldn't assume that there would be limits militarily to what we would be prepared to do for countries, again, with whom we're allied and where the balance, shall we say, worked more in our favor. So actually, one of the things I would do in this crisis, I'd be sending more air and naval forces to Asia just to send the message that you shouldn't think we're so distracted and so forth. I would play around the entire chessboard at this point.
Focusing on the home front, is your opinion that transforming America into a kind of social welfare European Union is a proper transformation?
Well, that's what we call a loaded question. The answer is no, but I don't think there's much chance of that. When I look at the degree of the welfare state in Europe, the size of the public sector, the the regulatory overhang. It's all heavier there. But I think we as Americans have to ask ourselves certain questions about the size of government. In particular, the thing that worries me most is in the last couple of years, you know, we've had a very narrow conversation about federal spending. It's been a dumb conversation because we haven't distinguished between investment and spending. Not all federal spending is equal. But even more, we haven't touched entitlements. So if we want to do something about the size of government, we want to do something about the debt, hello, you got to deal with entitlements. But they've been put off the table. That's not serious. So let's get serious here. So if we want to do something about the real economic trajectory, that's what we have to tackle. Let me give you another way. Here we are in oil land. I find it politically, I'll be generous here, frustrating. We have done amazing things as a society in the last couple of years to increase the production of oil and gas. It is transformational. It has, as a result, taken away one of our great strategic vulnerabilities in a way that nobody I know in my business anticipated. But what we've done is increasingly allowed our other strategic vulnerability, which is the necessary inflows of dollars, to grow. That doesn't make a lot of sense. I mean, think about the Ukraine crisis. I mentioned before Russian vulnerability because of economic integration. Imagine Russia held enormous amounts of dollars, and their purchase of treasuries was central to the functioning of the American economy, and suddenly their central bank president said, well, we're not going to do that. We're going to stop buying treasuries. And suddenly Janet Yellen was forced to jack up interest rates, not to cool and overheat an American economy, but basically to attract the necessary funding for our debt. Suddenly the economic balance of power here would not be so comfortable. We are allowing ourselves to be far more vulnerable than we should, but the problem is that a lot of Americans who rail on against, nobody in this room I'm sure, but who rail on against the size of government, but then when you basically say let's raise the Social Security age or change the cost of living adjustment, say no way. Well, we talk about looking at limits to Medicare coverage, they say no way. Okay, well you can't have it both ways. You can't criticize the size of government and basically say entitlements are off limits. And simply to control or put limits, as the sequester does, on forms of discretionary domestic spending is a bad idea because we ought to be investing in some cases there. So if you sense that I am not totally at one with the fiscal direction of our country, it's because I am not totally at one with it. I just lost a few votes, Randall.
If you could tap Angela Merkel's phone right now, what do you think she would be saying about the upcoming G8 and about the Ukraine?
First of all, anyone in the intelligence business who would tap Angela Merkel's phone rather than Francois Hollande's phone is out of his mind. Come on. Let's just get serious here. But I digress. This is interesting, actually. One of these sources of challenge during the Cold War was to get the Americans and the West Europeans on the same page about how to deal with the Soviet Union and whether it was a question of how to deal with the new generation of missile deployments or human rights or what have you, how to deal with Czechoslovakia in 68 or what have you. There were always differences. And I think we're going to have the same thing now. I actually think there's going to be elements of U.S.-European divergence over how, robust to be this vis-a-vis Mr. Putin. Now, in some cases, because they have energy dependencies, they have greater economic stakes. Again, they're closer. European default option instinctively is a little bit more, let's work things out, let's not be too confrontational. So my guess is you're going to see gaps growing up. First of all, within the German government, and between the United States and Germany and other Europeans. So this is going to be an exquisite diplomatic management thing, and Putin's going to want to play us off against them. So, you know, John Kerry went to Kiev. I actually would have sent John Kerry to Berlin. That would have been my first stop for the Secretary of State.
Thank you. Let me go on to a little different tangent.
Okay.
The Russians have been interested in the Middle East from way back.
Yeah.
And you describe a state of unrest persisting, which suits their feeling it's time to intervene. Do you think they will?
No way. Look, Russia's a country of 143 million people. 143. It's been shrinking, basically. It's stabilized around 143 million. Just to give you, that's more than 40 million less than Pakistan. Russia's not a great power anymore. Russia has a mediocre military, has some rusting nuclear weapons. Enormous tracts of its territory are under or unpopulated. It's got a top-heavy political system. The corruption is on a colossal scale. It's a cash crop economy. It doesn't have a real economy. This is not a great power. Russia also has at least 10 to 15% of its people who are Muslim. They're scared of the Middle East. They are scared that radicalism is going to come out of the Middle East and lead to the further dismemberment of their country. Indeed, the only chance I think that Russia will play a serious role in Syria is that they will begin to see the creating of a new generation of terrorists, of jihadists, who go to Syria. It's kind of like terrorism 201 or 301, and then come home to Dagestan and places like that. That's what's going to get them to ultimately do something about it. And after Afghanistan, there is zero, 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 zero appetite in Russia for that kind of imperial adventure far field. So you can have a long list of things you worry about, but Russian military intervention on any scale in the Middle East is not. They don't have the appetite. They don't have the capability. They don't have the strategic rationale for it.
Hey, Richard, I've been evangelizing the importance and the significance of trade just to get there's another additive to economic growth and so forth in the U.S. And I think it's really, really important for us as a country, and particularly a transatlantic trade deal and, and how vital it would be just for the European Union as well. But I'm sitting here listening to you talk, and I'd be curious to hear your thoughts on the significance of a transatlantic trade deal as it relates to foreign policy and stability in Ukraine and Hungary and so forth.
Okay. I'm a big believer in trade, too, for two reasons. One is economically. There's all sorts of statistical stuff that suggests the trade is good for the American exports, and particularly for high-level exporting jobs. Second of all, trade has always had a strategic dimension where it helps integrate countries and gives them, you know, it's not a guarantee, but it does give them an added incentive or stake in orderly arrangements. I think the first thing teed up is Asia, the Trans-Pacific Partnership. I'd love to see a trade deal there. For both economic and strategic reasons, we would benefit enormously because other countries already have far more access to American markets than vice versa. My concern is Congress. Many Democrats, probably a majority of Democrats, will vote against any free trade deal. Doesn't help when the Senate leader has already announced his opposition to any free trade deal. And a growing number of Republicans are no longer free trade. That generation of Republicans is kind of, you know, the Dick Lugar generation is gone, and this new generation is much less instinctively, shall we say, free trade. I think a European trade deal would help. I mean, it'd particularly help the European economies, because they're, as you know, they're barely growing at all. It'd be useful to them. And also, it'd also help knit together the United States. In an era when NATO and the security institutions count for less, it'd be good to have greater economic integration between the United States and Europe. I mean, the question is, if it's US-EU, then Ukraine's not part of it. So, you know, that's got an unfortunate dimension. The question is whether you'd make an exception. I also don't think they're up for it. I doubt whatever criteria you set they could meet. I mean, Ukraine's a real mess. I mean, it is really bad. But you'd want to, and I have to think about it, right? But how you'd set it up in a way that it didn't look like those who didn't get in were trying to somehow be letting adrift. So if you're not in NATO, you're not in the so-called TAFTA, the Transatlantic Free Trade, or you're not in the EU, you don't want certain countries to kind of be out there hanging, which is exactly what Putin would want. So we'd have to think about what it is we did and get in some kind of associate status. So I'd love to go out and negotiate, but I actually think the bigger question, whether it's Asia or Europe, is domestic, whether our friends in Congress will support free trade. And the only chance it has of happening, I think, is if the White House makes it an enormous priority. This president would have to basically say, for the next couple of years, I'm going to make this, maybe along with protecting Obamacare, he would have to make that his biggest domestic priority, and I don't see any signs yet he's prepared to do that. Without that, I don't think it – and by the way, if we can't pass it, it's a major strategic setback. Coming back to the first question about American reliability, if it turns out we are unable or unwilling to support major trade deals, it will reinforce the perception that the United States is not a serious, dependable partner. So this has now taken on added substance and symbolism alike. But we've got a very talented trade guy now, Mike Froman. I actually think it's probably going to be more difficult for him to negotiate in Washington than it will in the field, and I know, which is quite a statement.
Diana Newton from SMU at the Tower Center. Thank you, Richard, so much. I'd like to turn to a part of the world that I know is, if not near and dear to your heart, at least taking up a lot of your travel time, which is Northern Ireland. And I'd love to hear about the future of peace and stability there. And then also, since territorial issues are the theme of the day, is there any chance that that will become a unification of Ireland, or is that division here to stay?
See, I was hoping I could get through this. Isn't time over?
Not quite.
Damn. Okay. I could start telling jokes. Okay. I've had two experiences with Northern Ireland in my life. I was the U.S. envoy after George Mitchell for 3 years when W was president. And just got called back into duty about 7-8 months ago. For those of you who do not follow this breathlessly, it's been about 15 years since most of the Civil War and fighting stopped in Northern Ireland. We had 3 decades of so-called troubles. 3,600 people lost their lives, and this was largely the end of what was known as the Good Friday or Belfast Agreement in 1998. Negotiated the United States, Britain, and Ireland, and it was all about Northern Ireland. Northern Ireland is a part of the United Kingdom. Remember, it's the United Kingdom of Great Britain and Northern Ireland. There's 1.8 million people in this region. You've got England, Scotland, Wales, and Northern Ireland as the constituent parts of the United Kingdom. And there's two questions. What's the balance? What happens inside Northern Ireland? There was a civil rights movement there where Catholics pressed for... Right, so there's a question of life within Northern Ireland, and then there's the question of the political status. Does Northern Ireland stay as part of the United Kingdom, or as many people, an unknown percentage of people, particularly in the Catholic community, want, does it unify with Ireland, with Dublin? So there's a question of, again, the nature of the society, and there's the political status of the territory, two separate issues. Again, there was a civil conflict for 3 decades that ended. Local political institutions in the north called devolution were set up. I tell you more than you wanted to know. This is all, then over the last 15 years, things have been kind of rickety. So anyhow, what happened about last spring is the leaders of Northern Ireland, the 5 parties that constitute the local, the executive of the assembly got together, kind of set out a blueprint for the future. The problem was the gap between the blueprint for the future, which talked about a shared society, and the reality was large and growing. This is the most segregated society in Europe. Something like 90 to 95% of the kids in Northern Ireland go to single tradition schools. the neighborhoods. You either live in most cases, a Protestant neighborhood or a Catholic neighborhood. There's about 100 concrete peace walls in Belfast, literally with concrete barriers, concertina wire. It's very hard to imagine in 21st century Europe. It's as divided as it is. Fortunately, the violence is way down. There's still some sporadic violence by various splinter groups. The problem is not so much the terrorists anymore as it is just the friction in the society and the potential for that to get ever larger and to get worse and worse, and then who knows what that leads to. So the political leaders got worried about the future, decided they needed help, and I got a call last summer to ask if I would help mediate the future of Northern Ireland, sit down with the leadership of the five parties. So I was brought in by them. I wasn't representing our or any government. And I basically spent 6 months in the fall trying to negotiate, if you will, a blueprint for the future of Northern Ireland with the leadership of the five parties. There were three sets of issues we dealt with. One is this question. You see, now it gets really crazy. It's good you're sitting down. One is this question, what's called parading or marching. There's a tradition, particularly in the Protestant community, where these social orders have these marches or parades. They often go through Catholic neighborhoods. Needless to say, they're not always welcome. Last year alone, there were 4,300 marches in a society of 1.8 million people. Secondly, there's the question of the flag. I kid you not. How many days over what buildings is the Union flag to be flown? What other flags or symbols are allowed to be flown over other buildings? Thirdly, and perhaps most significantly, there's never been a legal, political, social, psychological process in Northern Ireland of dealing with the 3,600 people who died. How do you deal with that? What kind of legal pursuits are encouraged? How do you get people to come forward? What's the trade-offs between information and prosecution? Anyhow, we dealt with all those three things. We negotiated for 6 months, came up with a 40-page document, and at the last hour, two of the parties decided they could not sign onto it. Two of the parties did. One of the parties wasn't sure. So that was December 31st at 4:30 in the morning. One of my recommendations is never give a press conference on December 31st at 4:30 in the morning after not having slept for 2 days. It's good advice, particularly for your students. It's not career enhancing. Anyhow, it sits there. It's now 2 months later. We've got St. Patrick's Day coming up. Several will be coming to Washington next week. I'll see them there. The leader of the largest party, even though he could not support the agreement at the end, said that he knows these issues need to be tackled. They will have to be tackled. My hunch is nothing much is going to be tackled for the next few months through the European elections, the end of May. But one way or another, Northern Ireland's going to have to come back to these things. You've got to deal with your past before you can deal with your present and future. And these issues that add friction to everyday life have to be tackled. They may seem small or even silly. You know, here we are, we talked about what's going on in Crimea. You talked about what's going on in Syria or between China and Japan. And the idea that you have people marching through neighborhoods seems, you know, just an anachronism. And it may well be, but it's still a divided society. So not quite sure what else to say, but that's where it stands. So whether your things get worked out, I don't know. I could see Northern Ireland succeeding. I could see it descending into violence. I could see it staying somewhere uncertain in between. We'll just have to see how it plays out.
We're really about out of time, but if I might, Richard, we have a table full of young women from the Hockaday School in
okay.
the back of the room. Do you have a few words to say to them? If they're interested in the Foreign Service and diplomacy, what they might be thinking about as they go through their academic career?
Look, I would say whether you're thinking of a career in this or not, you know, people who are young now, you're going to have 21st century lives. Your life's going to parallel the century. Your life is going to be affected by the world in fundamental ways. So you want to know about it. So that means you want to read about it on a regular basis. You want to, where you can, travel, understand a little bit what's going on in the world, understand some foreign policy questions. So whether you join the Foreign Service or the military, the U.S. government, whether you go to work for AT&T or for an oil company, or whether you don't do any of those things, you're a citizen. You're going to have to decide who to vote for and how to vote. Your job is going to be challenged by imports at some point or about new technologies. You're going to have to think about your physical safety. So, you know, 21st century lives are going to be globally connected in ways that are really without precedent. So I just think the argument for knowing about the world, familiarizing yourself with the world are powerful. I've actually made at the council the biggest project that we're going to launch going forward is what we call global literacy. You know, you need to have young Americans who can think critically, write, speak, count, all those kind of neat things. But we also need young Americans, not just young Americans, are going to have to know about the world. And it just seems to me you're not going to be able to compete successfully economically or have anything like the sort of life you want unless you are, to some extent, comfortable and able to navigate a world that will increasingly not respect borders. So I would just make it part of your formal education, and I'd make it part of your life whenever you have the opportunity.
For more information about the World Affairs Council of Dallas-Fort Worth, visit them on the web at www.dfwworld.org.